So our retreat is shifting. In a very natural way, conditions change and we'll be going home tomorrow. And often it is helpful to just remind ourselves, maybe for inspiration or to support the intention for taking the practice home. And so I'll share a few thoughts about some of this, some of the things that have been particularly supportive for me. I joked with Diana the other day that the extent of this talk could be something like same practice, different objects. And that's essentially what happens here, that the instructions for this particular style of practice, it's one of the reasons I love it so much, that the instructions don't change substantially on or off the cushion. And you've seen that, I think, in your meditation here, in the same practice, sitting, walking, eating, brushing your teeth, in between times. It's all the same practice. And yet, one particular piece that does, at least in my own experience, feel different on retreat and off retreat. Well, there's a couple, actually. I'll really highlight a couple. But one of the first ones is that here, what we're doing, all that we're doing really, is cultivating mindfulness. That's our job here as yogis. You know, we don't have to log on to the computer and check our email and do all this other stuff. We don't have to go to work. We don't have to take care of we don't even have to make food here. We don't have to go shopping. We don't have to keep lists. Maybe some of you do, but there's just much less need to hold content in the mind on retreat. And we do need to hold content in the mind in our daily lives. And so this practice around reminding ourselves to be aware, the prompting, I think I talked about prompted and unprompted mindfulness early on in the retreat, that we prompt ourselves to be aware here. Just reminding in a gentle way, am I aware? Checking in, already aware, just kind of noticing that, highlighting the awareness, that little tap, tap, tap of the scooter that we've been talking about. That activity, if you're trying to carry that activity into our daily activities, oftentimes it feels to me that it gets swamped by the other things that we need to do. So the energy or the effort that we have to make to direct our minds towards these things have to happen today and in this order and so just the kind of the ordering of our day, we don't have as much bandwidth for that, trying to prompt a continuity of mindfulness. And so the way effort happens, at least for me, one of the key ways that I found and probably my main practice off the cushion is recognizing the moments of mindfulness returning rather than trying to continually prompt the mindfulness. Just noticing those moments returning. That moment, as we've talked about, is effortless. And so it's nothing that we have to work to accomplish. And if we begin to attune to it in daily life, especially, and it does take a little bit of energy, a little bit of connection. And maybe we could say it's really the intention to connect with it. It's the intention to connect with that moment of remembering. If each morning you wake up and just remind yourself, yes, I want to explore connecting with the return of the moments of mindfulness, that intention begins to help us to see these moments of mindfulness returning. And, you know, what I'd say is the conditions for noticing that, you know, we get familiar in a way. Here on retreat in particular, it seems like we get familiar with places or ways in which we remember mindfulness, various places in the building. We might start to notice, oh yeah, I've forgotten every time I walked into the dining hall. And then we start to get curious about that. And then that starts to wake us up. And so we start to cultivate these little pockets of awareness and pockets of places where the awareness spontaneously returns here on retreat. And so in our daily lives, especially when we're doing something novel, you know, in our regular routine, we may start to cultivate those little pockets of mindfulness returning, washing the dishes or making our bed or doing various kind of daily chores. We may start to you know, the mindfulness returning starts to become very familiar. And so it's like doing that activity can create that moment of mindfulness returning. And so the more that we notice those moments in our daily life, the more that they begin to point themselves out to us. And the interesting place, or one of the more challenging places, and this I see a lot for people, you know, when they say they go away on vacation or something, and then they realize, I lost my practice. Partly because some of the cues or prompts that we have in our everyday life go away. And so, you know, again, you might just connect with the intention to cultivate that when you enter into a novel situation. Just, maybe I'll be able to be mindful here. May I notice the mindfulness returning here? I think in novel situations, there is a kind of a little surfacing of being aware, and yet it's often swamped by then trying to navigate, well, what do I need to do here? And so we don't stay mindful. So the you know, just this noticing of the moments of mindfulness returning, at least in my experience, seems to, well, first of all, it helps us notice them more, and we begin to recognize they happen way more and just naturally, these moments of being aware, knowing what's here, happens way more than we would have thought. So just this kind of orienting to the intention towards that. One of the most helpful practices that that I've taken away. Another really supportive, it feels like a tool for me, but it's not exactly a practice, but it's just you know, really emphasizing in a way curiosity. And we do that here. We begin to get curious about our minds and how they function and what's going on. And so if we can connect with curiosity, you know, as we talked about a few days ago, curiosity is a very natural motivator for energy and effort towards the practice if we're interested in what's going on. And so sometimes it can be useful not to necessarily just say, oh, let me be curious about my whole day, but if there are particular areas of experience or particular areas of life where it seems like we tend to have those mindfulness sinks, you know, those places where mindfulness just swirls down the rabbit hole regularly. So that whole exploration around where do we lose mindfulness, you know, might be in particular activities or it might be with particular mind states. So if you notice there's certain times that the mindfulness gets lost, then being curious about what happens there. And so this might look something like, you know, for myself, one of the first practices I explored in daily life, actually my very first practice before I even started meditating, formally meditating, was curiosity about anger, because I could see that anger was really harmful in my life. And I had read something that pointed me to, it might be helpful to be mindful of it. And so that began to be kind of, it sparked my curiosity about, can I know when I'm angry, while I'm angry? You know, can I know that? And so that exploration, just the kind of the curiosity to notice a habitual pattern in my life. And I've used that many, many times in my life, kind of picking up, wow, the mind really gets caught in that in my daily life, in that mood, in that depression, in that frustration, in that impatience. And so beginning to be curious about, how does impatience show up? How does depression show up? And kind of orienting and almost setting it as an intention. Again, intention's actually pretty big in daily life practice. Setting it as an intention towards, okay, may the mind be interested and curious and aware when that state of mind happens. Or maybe when a particular activity, if you notice, you know, when you're driving that you lose mindfulness, or when you're having a conversation with this particular person, you lose mindfulness. So just the kind of sparking of curiosity there, not as a way to, like, you know, it's not about beating ourselves up. Again, it's just about what's going on in there. How does the mind get hooked by this over and over and over again when it begins, you know, even though it knows it's painful? What happens there? What happens? And so the curiosity is a real support for us in our daily lives. Another big area of somewhat of difference in a way in retreat practice and daily life practice, although, you know, we are exploring here, and especially in these last couple of days, exploring content and how content affects us. But in, you know, on retreat, we do have the luxury of not having to engage in content as much. You know, we don't really have to think too much about how we're going to get through our day. We may think a lot about how we're going to get through our day. It's amazing how much we end up planning on retreat. I'm going to do this first, and then I'm going to take my shower, and then I'm going to go for a walk. And that the habit of planning is just so strong. And yet, in daily life, we have got to engage with content. The content of our relationships, the content of work, the content of what it means to drive down the road, the content of staying engaged with what's happening in the world. So there is, to me, a little bit of extra kind of attention that we may need to bring in daily life. So maybe this is one of the different objects, perhaps, different object, the attention to content. Whereas on retreat, we can kind of say, oh yeah, there's content, and, you know, not need to engage much with it, but just kind of be curious about, how does that content affect me? Kind of orient more towards the impact that the content has than the content itself. In our daily lives, we need to have much more of a fluidity of being a back and forth with content, having a sense of staying connected with content and knowing how we are with that content. And so this is a little bit more practice with this. Sayadaw Utejaniya sometimes points to, he calls it 50-50 mindfulness. 50% of the attention on what we're doing, the content of it, and 50% of the attention on how we are with it. And sometimes people would come up and ask him, so how do I know if it's 50%? And he's and he said, it doesn't matter. It just needs to have some kind of balance between them. It's like, maybe it's 60% of the attention on content and 40% on how I am. And this kind of flow, and I kind of saw this actually in my computer work. It's like sometimes with the concentrated work that we do, it's appropriate for, you know, 80% of the attention to be on the content and a little bit checking in with how I am. Am I, you know, tight like this while I'm sitting in front of the computer, or is the body relaxed? Not so much, you know, knowing, oh, how does that line of code make me feel internally? You know, but a much more general kind of thing. And yet there are times when it may make sense to be, you know, more engaged in the inner, like when there is a conversation, we tend to be more, you know, like all of our attention goes perhaps to listening, and it's like we leave ourselves. And so this, some of what we've been playing with in the last couple of days, playing with that, how are you while listening, taking in the content and knowing how you are with that content. So in daily life, there's a couple other ways to practice with this. So basically, in terms of practice, you know, the reflection around talking and listening, like the engagement with conversation, the engagement with content and conversation. Here again, some of you at least have described and reported that there has been some capacity for mindfulness in the conversations, and how lovely that's been. And so it gives you a taste of the possibility. But probably when you go back, there will be conversations with partners, conversations with coworkers, that the habit of those conversations, the habit of those relationships, means that the mindfulness doesn't stay engaged. And also sometimes the content being a little more charged takes us away from the mindfulness. And so some places to practice around content that might be a little more charged. So in reading, we are taking in the content of somebody else's mind. So it's kind of like slowed down listening when we're reading something. And so a place to practice with charged content is perhaps reading the news. Read a headline. And don't just dive into the article. Take time to, it's like, there's the headline. How does that land? Initially, in our exploration of this, we may have to do a little bit of back and forth and slowing it down. And in reading, we have that possibility. We can slow it down because we are in charge of how fast the information comes in. We can read a headline, see how it feels. We can read a couple of sentences of the article, see how it feels. And maybe do a little bit of this back and forth. You know, in conversation, it doesn't, you know, make so much sense to, you know, be listening, say, wait, stop that. I need to feel. Okay, now you can say your next sentence. Now that doesn't work so well in conversation. And yet we can begin to learn to do it dynamically, kind of in tandem, knowing the content and how we feel simultaneously. But initially, it may need to be a little bit of taking some content. How am I with that? Taking some content. How am I with that? And likewise with offering the content of our minds to other people, which is what we do when we're talking. A time when we're slowing that down, so that we can know how does that, first of all, you know, kind of how does that content affect me, but also a kind of almost an imagining or a reflecting, how might this content land on some with somebody else? These words, how might they be felt? Because that's part of the care and the ethics and the why speech is understanding not only our motivation for saying things and the, whether it's a skillful motivation, but also a kind of an empathetic understanding of how it might be felt when heard. And so in writing, we can also slow down that, especially you could play with this if you're writing a kind of a charged message, a charged email or something. You know, I find if I'm writing something where there's some kind of emotional charge, I may write it first just fast and kind of just try to feel the basic feelings and then go back and then read it and feel kind of how it lands for me as if I was the listener, as if I was the receiver. Make some edits so that, you know, you get some practice with this, checking into how it feels to receive the contents of your own mind. So that's quite a bit. I think I'll just stop there and see if Diana wants to offer any reflections.
Thank you. I'll offer, it's been enormously impactful for me to in daily life, to notice and appreciate and feel. What does it feel like when mindfulness re-arises, when it shows up? Often there's like a little, just a little flicker of like, I don't know what it is exactly. It's kind of a relief, like, oh, okay, here I am. And then whew, off I am again or something. But somehow kind of like involving the body or the just the felt sense of what it's like to when mindfulness re-arises, for me, I found is a big support to help encourage that. Then maybe one more thing that I'll say is that so much about meditation practice and, dare I say, even Dharma practice is about softening or letting go, making space. A big part of that is there's so many different ways we can do that in our lives that will help support our meditation practice. Includes things like, I mean, the kind of the stereotypical Buddhist thing to say is generosity, this idea of offering something to someone else, something else. But very often this can be the benefit of the doubt, or service, helping somebody. It doesn't have to be, you know, monetary, but just this movement of the heart of wanting to be generous, that kind of letting go, that softening, really supports having a mind that's a little bit more pliable and malleable and can let go of some tight views or something. And that kind of mind is one in which mindfulness just is easier to arise in. So we can just, in our daily life, organize our lives in such a way that we can support this. I'm going like this with my hands. What is this? Spaciousness, openness, ease, letting go, whatever it feels like for you, and in whatever form that takes. So I offer this.
I want to explore some questions, any questions you might have. And there was one that came to me a couple of days ago, one of you left as a note, and it seemed relevant to at least speak to at this point in the retreat in terms of going home. And there was a question about, basically given the divisiveness in our world right now, in our culture, in here in the United States in particular, ways, what is some of the wisdom that of the Buddha that can help us to meet, respond to, open to, behold this divisiveness and pain, suffering? So I thought I'd say a few words about that. And first of all, I'll just say, you know, the world is much as was when you left it. Same old stuff. And so you will be walking back into that mess of the world. And it's painful. It's very painful. And the first thing that occurs to me to say here is that the Buddha offered tools for understanding suffering and coming to the end of suffering. And while often in our private meditation practice, we are exploring the suffering internally, how it's created internally, and the forces of greed, aversion, and delusion at work in our own hearts and minds, I do think that some of the tools of the practice and of the Dharma, of the tools that the Buddha offered, can help us to meet that external suffering. To begin to open to greed, aversion, and delusion, not only as forces here, and as we've been seeing, I mean, we look in our own minds, we see these happen, right? It's like, it's not personal. We begin to recognize that these forces are at work, multiplied by nearly 8 billion. And so the beginning to recognize that, you know, kind of like, well, look at the mess inside the mind, you know, how much greed, aversion, delusion, how confused this mind is, and multiply that 8 billion times. And it's like, well, of course, there's a mess in the world. So three of the key kind of pieces that resonate for me in terms of opening to, holding, trying to understand, to meet the suffering, to meet the divisiveness, to explore ways to heal sometimes. Three main pieces, ethics, love, and wisdom. You know, ethics really helps us, grounding in ethics really helps us to recognize non-harming action is so important. You know, taking action, ethics, we know that ethics is not about non-action, even though, you know, in some, we might think ethics is about non-action given the way that the precepts are framed, is refraining from acting, refraining from taking life, refraining from taking what's not given, etc. But the basic foundation of ethics is action without harm. And in the Buddha's teaching to his own son, he really encouraged this. He says, reflect before you act. Is it going to cause harm? And if not, act. Reflect while you're acting. Is this causing harm? If it is, stop. If it's not, continue. And reflect afterwards, did it cause harm? And if it did, undertake restraint in the future and, you know, make amends. Find ways to potentially to make amends. Not always, making amends may not always look like what we think it would look like, but so in any case, the ethical teachings of the Buddha are not about non-action, but they're about skillful action, recognizing is action going to cause harm or not. And so it may be that we need to take very strong action if we see unethical actions in the world. And so, and yet not, this is where love can come in too. It's like not out of hatred for the other person making those unethical actions, but more out of compassion for the suffering that they are both causing and that they are actually experiencing, maybe unaware that they are experiencing. And so ethics, I think, is hugely important in this realm. Love and compassion to hold the suffering, the cultivation of love and compassion to hold the suffering. And wisdom and love really, to me, go hand in hand here. You know, wisdom to me is really my go-to doorway. That's, I think it's for me, that's my go-to doorway. I know that it's not for everybody, their go-to doorway, but for me, the wisdom doorway has been powerful in my own practice, but also in the practice in the world. And so I use reflection, wisdom reflection, to support kind of understanding, and also you know, just reflecting on the nature of this mind and realizing, for instance, you know, we see when we look in our own hearts and minds, that some of the wisdom that we've been exploring here is the conditioned nature of our experience. The conditioned nature of everything that arises in our minds, including our beliefs, our views, and our opinions. And so the seeing of that, the recognition that these beliefs that are happening here, you know, they've been conditioned based on what my parents believed, what their parents believed, what the overall culture I was connected with believed, what I was, you know, given in school, all of those things. It's like, the beliefs that have been shaped here are not just mine and mine alone. They have been shaped in a larger context. And largely, you know, this is not self. I didn't choose to have these beliefs implanted. You know, there are some beliefs that happen as we begin to engage and see. So for instance, the beliefs that have happened here around love and wisdom and compassion and ethics, those have been conditioned in me through meeting the Dharma. So the whole thread there of the Dharma understanding that has come in, and the engagement there, the choices that has supported in terms of my own orientation. And so, you know, but even those conditions, they have their own stream. It's not, it's like the whole of the Dharma culture and wisdom being learned and immersed in. That also is conditioned. And so our views, our beliefs are not self. We see that so clearly at times, you know, thoughts arising of some belief, and it's like, wow, you know, that belief is, it's not even true. But there's some piece of our system that believes it in some way. So we begin to see the way our minds function around beliefs and views and opinions, and we can recognize, again, this is not just me. And so someone else has a completely different view than we do. And that too is not self. Their conditions came together to create that belief being strong. Now, what I think we need to explore, and perhaps with our understanding, so one of the, we see in our own personal practice the way mindfulness supports our seeing of views and beliefs as conditioned, the way it supports a kind of a holding things a little more lightly when we hold things with mindfulness. And I think, you know, maybe some of what we do here in community is cultivating this internally, but then we have the opportunity to take this capacity to meet suffering, to meet views and opinions out into the world and shed some awareness on it, shed some light on it. It may not look like something like, you know, telling somebody, gee, do you know you're just believing that and that's just a construct? You know, that may not go down very well. But there may be ways to engage and in conversation that supports not a kind of a solidification of our own views, but rather an exploration. And one time in one situation with someone who has very different political views than I do, we started having a conversation about an event that had been happening, a current event, and I started, you know, it started out with a little bit of the, you know, the kind of that kind of feeling of gotta hold on to like my point of view here. But then I started, you know, kind of approaching it with the language of, so I hear this is what you're saying, and this is my perspective. So I used the language of perspective and view, and said, you know, kind of clearly said, and this is what I heard you say, so that, you know, basically the other person, this is just kind of natural, I think, basic conversation skills in terms of mediation almost. It's like, what I heard you say was this, so that they know that they were heard. And this is my perspective. And with this person, it didn't actually take too long before that person started using the same language. And boy, did I feel a difference in my own self, you know, for having that person say, oh, this is my perspective, and oh, I see, this is what you're saying. You know, it's just like created a whole different dynamic in the conversation. I don't think either of us changed our views. And yet, the conversation began, at least. So, you know, I don't certainly have the answers here. You know, this is huge, this level of divisiveness. But I think, you know, remembering that everyone has been conditioned, for me, that's really helpful. You know, to just remember these conditions arising in my own heart and mind. You know, they are conditioned, and that everyone else is acting based on their condition too, and feeling the suffering to some extent of people that do not understand that. You know, I know for myself how much suffering was happening in my system before I really understood what was going on. And so some sense of like the heart kind of opening to when I see somebody in the news or something, you know, just saying things that are so, feel so painful to me. It's like, oh, you know, it's coming from that fear, perhaps, maybe coming from that sense of needing to protect, and, you know, all this confusion of those, you know, wishing to be safe, happy, and healthy, and impermanent, unreliable, uncontrollable, and the tangle of that. Now, that's what we're really experiencing in our society, is the tangle of that. And that perhaps the part of what we can do as practitioners is begin to hold that suffering in some way, to be a witness for the suffering in some way. The other thing I'll just mention for the person who wrote the question, you know, in terms of if this is something of interest to you, these types of reflections of how Dharma teaching, Dharma understanding can touch into our social and societal issues. Someone in our community, in the IMC community, took the initiative to go through the Dharma talks that Gil and I have given in the last couple years and pull out ones that we've given on these topics, on topics like this. And so there's a place on the nav bar on Audio Dharma, social, political, or social something concerns. And clicking on there, you'll see a whole bunch of, there's some about the environment and some about some of the issues of the day. And so there are some, I think there's probably 20, 25 Dharma talks there touching on a whole host of these kinds of things and how we can meet it with Dharma understanding and explore the wisdom of what the Buddha had to offer in a societal way, in a larger way than, and not just in terms of our own personal uprooting of greed, aversion, and delusion.